Hello and welcome to the Consumer Choice Center cast. I'm Yair Osovsky, Deputy Director here at the Consumer Choice Center. It's the 12th of October, and I'm speaking with a very interesting gentleman. He is a research fellow here at the Consumer Choice Center and also at the Institute for Research in Economic and Fiscal Issues, as well as an assistant editor at Speak Freely, Mr. Ryan Khurana. Ryan is here to talk to us a little about automation, artificial intelligence, and the future of employment. So welcome to this short but brief Consumer Choice Center cast, Ryan.
Thank you, Eyal, for having me on.
So the thing that we like to talk about today and kind of explore is I'll be linking two of your articles that you've written on this topic. And I think this is very important, not only for people who are in the economic realm, but also consumers. You know, if we're talking about completely changing the labor market and the workforce, this is something that will have a huge impact. So if you could just for me sum up your kind of essential argument that you make in your article for the Institute for Research in Economic and Fiscal Issues, and how that relates to the future of work and whether or not the poor and destitute peoples will be put out of work by robots and artificial intelligence.
Sure thing. So basically the premise of my argument and the research that I do is that I think the fear of automation is quite overblown. And I think it's overblown because there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what a job really is. Now, when a new technology comes out, for example, like the self-driving car, which can understand the road and maneuver it with similar aptitude to an individual, people think that this replaces the work of a human driver because it can do what that driver spends a lot of his time doing. Now, a job is more than the tasks you do, and automating certain tasks does not replace the human effort involved in a job. And the focus of my work is to show that when we automate certain tasks that take up even most of the time of an individual in a job, it does not replace the full economic value of an individual. And what occurs is you change the skill requirements of those individuals to make up for the things they didn't have a lot of time to do. Now, a very practical historical example of this was the introduction of the automated teller. So in the olden days, before the 50s, the job of a bank teller was to update your bank balance and give you your cash. Now, that job took up most of their day, but it did not provide the bank with the most economic value. It was a very rote task. So originally, people predicted that an automated teller would make bank tellers redundant because it did what they spend most of their time doing. However, since the introduction of the ATM, we have twice the number of bank tellers globally that we had then. And the reason for this is fairly simple. The automated teller reduced the amount of space needed for the bank to do majority of their tasks. So they could open up more branches that were smaller. And in these more branches, they hired human tellers to do other things that they couldn't spend as much time doing before, namely providing better customer service, selling customers on new features, changing their accounts, and all this other stuff that really makes you loyal customer to that bank. That provides a lot more economic value. So what automation really does is allows people to focus on the tasks that provide the highest amount of economic value, which is better for both consumers and workers because it means that the price of doing business is lowered, which is better for the consumers as their prices get cheaper. But it's better for the worker because if they're only focusing their time on tasks with the maximum economic value, it means they're being more productive, and that should translate to higher wages relative to the decreasing prices.
Okay. And one thing that you do mention and highlight a little bit in your article, and I think that many people, whenever they think about this topic, are worried about, is particularly workers that are a bit older, that might not have some of the skills of the younger workforce who it's a bit easier for them to go and get education or learn how to code and learn how to, you know, learn various skills. So what happens to the kind of elder workforce whenever there is this kind of a threat that automation might maybe not take away their job, but at least reduce the capacity for them to do their job or perhaps provide an alternative to them working 8 hours a day on a particular task?
Yeah, so I think with the older workers, there's two issues. One is that what you mentioned was things like learning how to code. Now, a lot of my research suggests that STEM fields are not the fastest growing occupations. What are growing the fastest are social care type occupations, anything that involves a high degree of communication skills. Now, while I believe that this is easier to learn, simply if you have the economic incentive to become a more sociable person, you can invest in becoming one. It's not as difficult as learning to code. However, you're right that not everyone is a very sociable person, and what should we do for people that never needed these skills before? Now, there's a couple of things we can do. One of those things is, I believe, to allow the labor market to be more dynamic so that these jobs that require a high degree of social skills will adjust their wages to be relative to how much their economic value is.
So what does that mean for the labor market to be dynamic? What would that specifically mean in terms of
action? I'll give you a very practical example for the UK. So in the UK, there's a huge shortage in primary school teachers because most of the primary school teachers work for the state education system. And relative to the US, they earn considerably less pay. Now, this shortage means that despite the economy having a desire for more primary school teachers, it doesn't make sense for me, if I was a displaced worker, to invest my time to become a primary school teacher because the pay is not high enough. However, if you have a system in which parents can send their kids to different schools, even if it comes through a voucher system from the state or we allow more school competition, the pay for primary school teachers, the demand parents have for better schooling, that will lead their pay to get higher as the demand increases. You shouldn't have in a dynamic labor market, as in a where the wages reflect the demand for the job, a shortage of teachers. You should have exactly the number of teachers that are willing to work for that amount of money. Mm-hmm. And so when the demand is higher than the supply is, what that means is they're not being paid enough. And if you allowed people to invest their own money, they would be paid more. And people who are currently displaced workers, like the training to become a primary school teacher, yes, it is a certain amount of training. But if it makes sense to me to go through that training because the salary I'll receive, I would go through with it.
Sure. And I think one thing that has become very prescient in this is that there is a focus on what, as you mentioned in the kind of earlier part of the cast, what does a full-time job mean or what does work mean and kind of what the difference is. And I think this rise in the gig economy, as some have called it, as many people have side hustles, people have been able to pick up work either driving their car for a service like Uber or Lyft or Taxify, and at the same time kind of doing odd jobs on a site like Upwork or TaskRabbit or any of these things. Does the kind of rise in automation mean that there will be a push for people to have to do more of these things, or is this just being used as a way to supplement income?
So I actually think that this represents what work ideally should be. I think what we have with this conventional view that a job is I work for a company 8 hours a day until I retire is one that was existed simply because of the limitations of the economy at the time. Now, from an economic theory perspective, ideally everyone should be able to freely bargain with their employers and renew contracts on an individual basis. And what the gig is it lowers the transaction costs for an individual to find the clients that are willing to give them the exact amount of money that they desire for the service that they provide. By doing so, it means that they can switch what their tasks are from the day to day, depending on what they believe is best to earn them the amount of money for the work that they want to do. So that's an ideal for human work. Now, you want to always be engaged with what you're doing. You want to feel like you're being compensated exactly the value that you've contributed. And these new technologies, the platform such as Uber that provide that, mean that people have the ability to do this and match up with stuff that values their productive work as they feel it should be valued.
Mm-hmm. And this is obviously going to come about a bit quicker in terms of the reforms that you're mentioning in probably the more advanced societies that have very flexible labor markets, which you could argue would be United Kingdom, United States, Canada, even Germany. But there are many other countries, particularly in Europe, that do not have this and have a lot more rigid structure that they've built, such as in France and in Spain and in Italy. Sort of if we look at it across countries and regions, what could this kind of rise in not only automation, but for the argument to hold that we would need to have labor market reforms, kind of what will that look like in these countries and what kind of resistance do you think there is going to be to that?
Well, you already see it practically in the difference between France and the States when it comes to what we were talking about with the platform economy. So Uber is very highly regulated in France. The taxi lobby wanted to ensure that the current crop of taxi drivers do not lose out from this new platform. Now, in my view, when I was looking into this, I felt like the French government mischaracterized how they viewed Uber. And a similar thing happened with the regulations in London and the ones currently coming underway in Norway, where they didn't understand how this technology worked. So they just thought it was a slightly more efficient taxi company. By doing so, what has occurred is the prices for these services have not dropped as quickly in these European countries as they have in the States. And by those prices dropping in the States quite quickly, aside from a few urban centers, I know California has more stringent regulations on Uber than some of the other states, the prices have dropped there quite quickly, which has facilitated a huge push in new economic activity. If it costs me less to get an Uber every day rather than a taxi, I'm using Uber more. I'm facilitating different types of transport that I wouldn't have done earlier. I can go get a meeting if I don't own a car much faster. I'm wasting less time. I can spend more of my time doing other things. So everyone is more dynamic as a result. And that comes from the fall in general prices. So when you have this resistance in a lot of these countries to these new technologies and to the more dynamic labor market rules, you have prices stay very fixed, which lowers the opportunity for social mobility, and it lowers the opportunity for innovation in other sectors that are unrelated because you don't have the reallocation of my money and my time that would have happened otherwise.
And I think that is a very important point for consumers in that, you know, you are able to save costs in many different areas, whereas you would spend, let's say, 60% of your disposable income on X or Y product or service. Because there's been a reduction in costs, you're now able to afford more, or perhaps have additional choices, other things that you can buy or purchase, or you can save more for education or for future investments. So at least for the consumer side, this should in the whole be a positive thing. Is that right?
Absolutely. When you're saving both money and time, and you're creating these, one of the innovations of the platform economy, such as Upwork, even eBay and Amazon, is it facilitates trust between people, because instead of me dealing with a stranger once, I'm basically having the aggregation of every single time everyone has interacted with a stranger to tell me how trustworthy this individual should be. And so when you have lowered the barriers to trust, when you have reduced the costs, and when you've reduced the time commitments, I can use all that to be far more productive in all walks of life otherwise.
So to go to a more pessimistic note very quick, because I think what you said is important, but it's also important to see the kind of reaction to that. And particularly, as we've seen in Europe, a lot of the digital companies and services that have kind of sprawled up or come over from the United States or actually been born in places like the UK, what they face is a kind of a very odd tax regime and very punitive taxes, as been seen in the case of Apple with Ireland that was forced by the European Union. And you're seeing a lot of this more now with Facebook and Amazon. So sort of what will the governments, what are they going to be doing in order to try to trap some of this income that is being either gained through, you could say, the gig economy or through kind of the digital services that we're all able to use? Sort of what will that mean for how governments view work in the future? And what could be any kind of proposals, perhaps, to address that?
Yeah, so I was at the Conservative Party conference in the UK last week, and they had a discussion, a panel about the gig economy. And one of their focuses was exactly this. One of the reasons why it's being more efficient is the fact that it's changing the market structure of these companies, which also changes their tax obligations. When you're an individual driver matching up with an individual rider, in the case of Uber, you're not doing this as a company as a whole. And what that means is you're not meeting the minimum threshold to be charged VAT. So the government is losing a huge amount of VAT as a result, but this is the reason why it's cheaper for consumers as well, because the VAT costs are not included. I do think you're going to have stiff resistance from some governments because VAT revenue and corporate tax revenue are huge contributors to the Treasury's purse. But at the same time, you have to understand that the reason why these companies are so successful is because they found a way to get around the kind of barriers that made other older companies stale. When older companies had to deal with all these tax obligations, their costs were higher. And these companies figured out a way to avoid those tax obligations, which makes them more competitive. Now, if you come up with a new regime, and I don't know what that new regime would look like, to figure out a way to tax these new companies, all that does is create the incentive for a different group of people to figure out another way to come up with a company that doesn't have those tax obligations and upend the current crop of companies that exist.
Definitely.
I don't think there exists a way to ensure that there's full that all new innovation exists only within the kind of tax framework we currently have, because it's not future proof.
Definitely. And you would say, though, that bringing in our earlier topic of kind of automation and the future of work and companies, though, you do view yourself as an optimist, then, that we are going to be able to have not only a more prosperous tomorrow, but that more people will be fulfilled in kind of their work and their economic output. Is that right?
Yeah, I am very optimistic about what these technologies can do. And I actually don't think they're going to do enough for the problems we're currently facing. Now, you hear a lot of this very pessimistic talk about how it's going to destroy traditional jobs. People will be left unemployed. But if you look at the demographic data, we have a rapidly aging population. Within 20 years, over 50% of the UK's population will be over 65. And the number of people over 85 is increasing rapidly as well. Now, you can't expect the far older group of the population to keep working forever. So you're going to have a lot of people leaving the workforce, which is bad for productivity. It's bad for tax collection. It also puts a lot of costs on the healthcare services. So you need innovation to make sure that this mass exodus that will eventually happen from the workforce isn't damaging to everyone. And I don't even know if this innovation is enough to make sure that that's the case.
Definitely. Well, we'll be looking out for that and hopefully reading much more of your articles. Again, that's Ryan Carana, a research fellow with Consumer Choice Center and all-around great writer on these topics. You can find more of his work on consumerchoicecenter.org. Follow him on Twitter as well, at Ryan Carana. Ryan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me. Have a nice day.
Cheers. Goodbye.